For our first panel, we'll go behind the scenes on DeFi and explore its early days and subsequent rise. Some of DeFi's original pioneers will trace how it's powering this next crypto boom. We have Tom Shaughnessy, co-founder of Delphi Digital, moderating this session. We'll turn it over to you, Tom, to introduce our first speakers and take it from here. Thanks for joining us.
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me host. It's great to be here. It's a crazy power lineup here. So we have Rune from MakerDAO, we have Stanley from Aave, Kane from Synthetics, and Rob from Compound. I don't think a lot in crypto is going to get done today with you guys on this panel right now. Got you all here. So Rune, why don't we start just with quick 30-second intros. We'll start with you because you're at the top and we'll go down the list.
Certainly. Yeah, I'm Rune Christensen, co-founder of the MakerDAO protocol, which is a DeFi project that's so old. The word DeFi didn't even exist in the first couple of years of the Maker project. And so what Maker does is it provides a decentralized platform for the creation of a stablecoin called the DAI stablecoin, which is worth $1, but has the same characteristics as something like Bitcoin, right? Being fully decentralized. At the same time, the way that the DAI stablecoin is created is through a peer-to-peer collateralized credit platform where people can lock up crypto assets and in the future, potentially even real-world assets to then generate the DAI stablecoin. So it's kind of like a central bank that anyone can have in their pocket and use to actually print their own money with. But of course, it's all fully backed and all fully on-chain verified by the blockchain.
That's awesome. Stanley, what about yourself?
I'm Stani from Aave. And Aave is a money market protocol where you can actually deposit stable coins like Maker's DAI and earn interest on it. And then you can draw credit line against your deposit or delegate your credit line to someone else or to a smart contract that does some sort of a yield strategy. We started with Aave. We were previously known as ETHLEND, short from Ethereum Lending, and we started in 2017. In the beginning, there wasn't stable coins back then, so DeFi wasn't a ecosystem as it is today. And thanks for practically multiple protocols and initiatives like Maker, Compound, Synthetics, Aave, that there is an ecosystem that we can actually now enjoy and see this different kinds of DeFi primitives. But
it's definitely growing. Kane, what about yourself, man? Talk about Synthetics and your background.
Kane from Synthetics. Like Aave, we started as a different project called Haven, and rebranded and pivoted to Synthetics. So Synthetics allows people to get price exposure to a range of different assets on the Ethereum blockchain. So gold, silver, Bitcoin, various equities, indexes, etc.
That's awesome. And Robert, last but not least, what's going on with your background in Compound?
Yeah, so Compound is a series of interest rate markets for different crypto assets. We pioneered the idea in 2017 and have had a few different iterations on these markets. Our goal at Compound was always to create a system that could be relied upon, could be stable, and could be safe to receive an interest rate on crypto. So, Rune mentioned, it's been around for years before the word DeFi existed. The term DeFi came out, about halfway through Compound's existence. But the goal has always been to create an interest rate accessible by users, smart contracts, and institutions. And the goal of the project at this point is opening that platform up to other developers and other institutions to govern and to build on top of.
That's awesome. So guys, let's dive right into yield farming because I think it's the most pressing kind of thing going on in crypto right now. So for those new to it, basically users are rewarded for a governance token on one platform for supplying assets, supplying outside assets. I want to get into the beginning of this though. Kane, I think you guys were the first, if I'm not mistaken, to kind of play with yield farming. Excuse me if I'm wrong here, guys, but just wondering, because you guys incentivized a pool kind of early on. Could you get into that and kind of your thoughts on where yield farming has gone?
Yeah, so you know, we actually started incentivizing people with the SNX token to stake within the SNX ecosystem first. And you know, that was going fairly well, but I think it was when we started incentivizing with the SNX token people to put liquidity into Uniswap that the composability and you know, the power of these incentives really kind of, you know, became obvious to people. So I think that was kind of the early genesis of this idea of, you know, paying people that liquidity, you know, in a native governance token.
Yeah, that's fair. And Rob and Sandy, I'll throw the question back to you guys. I mean, you have a ton of protocols using your platforms to yield farm now. Did you guys expect that level of, you know, crazy growth, not just from users, from protocols? And I guess, Rob, we could start with you and then go over to Sandy.
Yeah, so a lot of people believe that this latest wave of, you know, yield farming is sort of set off by Compound distributing a token. You know, what we started doing in June is distributing our governance token to users of the protocol just for using the protocol naturally. We didn't really anticipate this turning into like a frenzy. And what we've seen, you know, sort of what Kane discovered previously is that when you distribute tokens to users, they'll actually like jump through hoops to get them. And so we've seen a lot of activity flowing throughout the entire DeFi sector of, you know, extending this idea of like receiving tokens for usage. And it's become, you know, extremely popular, leading to all sorts of other things over the last, you know, couple of weeks and months. You know, projects like YFI and Yams and Sushi, and like there's right now this like very well-trodden path of leveraging usage for distribution of tokens. I think we're going to see a lot more experiments. The space is unfolding extremely rapidly, but you know, it's becoming an established piece of the space.
No, for sure. I'm with you there. Stanley, what's your thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. Like it kind of came unexpectedly in the same DeFi, the few years, incentives has always driven a bit of kind of adoption in the whole ecosystem. I think before stablecoins, the use case of, for example, what we had in terms of lending and borrowing, wasn't that interesting compared to, for example, what stablecoins did. And I mean, the very simple thing was that we saw a period before where stablecoins were giving yields for depositors better compared to, for example, traditional savings accounts. And that gave a lot of attention, and developers got excited to build things, and the whole community was interested about this. Now, then we saw now the yield farming and the kind of incentives on this community equity drive quite a lot of traction again. And it's nice because like in one sense, Aave doesn't have this kind of liquidity mining yet. But what's interesting is that, as Robert said, that it really drives the whole traction for the whole ecosystem and brings new users. And what we actually did this time is that it brought a lot of people from the very CeFi world and basically CeFi users who are holding Bitcoin and haven't used DeFi before are coming into the space and researching a bit. So I think that has been pretty cool thing. In terms of like how many projects we see coming with the same model, it's getting like there might be a risk of like a bit of fatigue in the sense that we see the governance giving the power to the users in a nice way to bootstrap a community, but some of the projects lack of bit of innovation in terms of coming with something new. And another thing is that this has been seen as a fair distribution model, but it becomes more of a distribution model that reminds federal banks where you print money and then the smaller accounts are then basically buying that equity. So there's like also kind of like this dark side as well into this topic.
Yeah, no, definitely dark side. I'm glad that the buzz is attracting new people to the space. And Rune, just to round out our question here, I mean, MakerDAO's stablecoin doesn't exactly, you guys don't offer yield farming itself, but you've been in the space for so long. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on yield farming, because I mean, DAI is like a foundational element of DeFi, and here we are doing, you know, complex things that kind of look like 2008, but kind of look like crazy innovation.
Yeah, Maker doesn't do yield farming itself, but has certainly been very strongly affected by it, in particular because, yeah, it's just, I mean, and Compound really started this, right? But through the yield farming programs, the demand for DAI has just totally exploded, which is still being dealt with in the Maker ecosystem right now. But I think, I mean, I think what's really important to like keep in mind is that I think it's not just the idea of yield farming itself, or sort of like the concept of yield farming itself, that I think is driving the current DeFi frenzy, right? It's a combination of this new interesting and novel incentive with the fact that there's some real innovation here as well, right? I mean, the potential of DeFi has been stewing for, you know, more than a year at this point, in my opinion, right? It's really been building up to this moment. And then it what it took was really, maybe the Compound distribution to kind of like set it off and just suddenly create a new level of attention on DeFi. That, I mean, I think is overall, it's super positive and beneficial. And I certainly feel much better about, this little, you know, bubble or rally or whatever you want to call it, compared to something like 2017, right? Where it really was mostly just no substance at all and just pure hype. This time around, I think the foundation of it is certainly that there's been a lot of real valuable development. But then, of course, also as Stani is saying, right, then, I mean, you can avoid that situation to then have the opportunists jump in then what we've seen is also it's turning into a bit of a whales game where the smaller players are being priced out because of scalability issues. But I think you can't, like, I mean, you need to accept those kind of drawbacks in order to get the bigger picture, which is that now there is there really is the beginning of exponential growth of DeFi, right? So this is the very beginning of something much, much bigger that, in my opinion, is fundamentally built on the fact that DeFi provides real value.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. And so, guys, the news in the market is kind of like SushiSwap, which is a DEX kind of copying Uniswap and Vampire attacking them, offering a lot of incentives to get their liquidity. And, you know, we've all known that protocols can be forked, and now it's actually happening. I'm wondering, I'll ask each of you, you know, we could all go in a row, what's the most valuable thing for your protocol that can't be forked? Or if you guys were forked, what do you think would keep your users on kind of your protocol? I'll throw this out for anyone to jump in, and we can just go down the row. Kane, how about you, man? You guys have, or go for it.
So, you know, a lot of people talk about, with new projects, the speed at which they come to market. And when a project comes to market very quickly and they're forked, you know, they're really starting from scratch, starting with a new community, starting without the expectations of how the protocol works, without established norms, without trust, without really any of these things. I think, you know, the biggest thing for Compound is that it's been operating without a single flaw for years. There's never been a loss of funds or even like a moment of crisis in Compound. And that goes to the strategy of what we're trying to create, which is, you know, a very stable, predictable, you know, trustworthy platform for, you know, larger applications and institutions. And, you know, there's a phrase called the Lindy effect, you know, where it basically says the longer something has been running without an issue, the more you can trust it. And we believe that. You can't fork, you know, the Lindy effect of a project that's been around for years. Especially when the customer is someone that's looking for years of flawless operations. And so, you know, I think that's one of the things that you can't, you know, fork. You know, at Compound, we've always advocated helping projects that fork off of us. You know, we believe that, you know, they should be running safely in the same way. But, you know, a code base, even if you, you know, copy paste it, you know, isn't going to be run or manage the same way between two different communities or organizations doing it.
That's fair. That's a really good point.
I'll jump in. So I think, you know, for us, when you see these like liquidity attacks, right, and you know something on like what's happened to Uniswap, it definitely opens your eyes to you know the potential that you may not have seen before, and you know potential attack vectors. But I do think that you know for us, and you know particularly DAI, even more so DAI, the thing that makes it you know so hard to just pull liquidity across is this kind of belief that's built up over time. Right, you know, it's this kind of monetary premium that's accrued to this asset that people genuinely believe it. And you could take, you know, the code and fork it, and you know, just deploy a new version of it. But it takes a long time to build up that level of belief in an asset like that, in something like DAI. And you know, and now, you know, we're starting to see that build in SUSD as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Bruin. Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what Rob and Kane are saying. And I mean, and one way to just really make it simple is you can say it's the brand, right? That's really, I mean, the brand is what carries all of these qualities in terms of technical security and, you know, the Lindy effect. But I think also, to me, what is extremely important is really things like governance and sort of the predictability and the quality of the community surrounding a project, right? Because one thing is whether the code is gonna break, and to some extent you can actually fork that, right? You can actually like fork the code directly, but you can't really so easily fork and convince the users that the governance isn't gonna do something crazy, right? Or gonna go in some strange direction. And I actually think that that's exactly why what we're seeing with like many of these forks. Maybe, I mean, SushiSwap, I think, is an exception. It's kind of like, it is doing this kind of like very, you know, it's almost like an attack, right? And really going head to head with Uniswap. But if you look at some of the other forks out there, to me, like they're mostly trying to take this twist of basically being a little bit more of like, yeah, like being exactly what you would expect a fork to be, trying to sort of go in some more quirky or sort of aggressive, maybe a little bit more risky directions. Or just like, you know, take like deciding on sort of like occupying a particular niche, right? I think one example is, you know, Cream Finance, which is a fork of Compound, right? And they're basically, you know, they've decided to just onboard all the sort of craziest collateral from across the DeFi space and sort of make it their focus, right? And another example is Reflexer, which is this upcoming fork of Maker. That's basically trying to go in the direction of like, you know, of, I guess you can call purity, right? Of sort of like making it a very simple design and sort of like locking down what governance is supposed to do. And in my opinion, that is actually, I think that's very constructive actually. And especially from the perspective of, I mean, I think, you know, a project like Maker that really likes to synergize with our projects and use them as collateral. It's really great to have a lot of different options available.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. And those are really great points. The other question I have for you guys is that there's always a battle between public founders and anonymous founders. So a lot of projects, obviously Bitcoin, a lot of others that are successful because they're anonymous, but now people are moving more towards, they want that brand, as Rune stated, they want a person they can look at that has social ties to a community that you can't break so that they can't, you know, exit scam away. Do you guys think that your protocols would be as successful as they are? And everybody here has, I think, over 500 million locked up in their platforms. If you guys were anonymous founders instead of known, free for anyone to jump in.
I mean, for me, I think it's very clear that's would just never work. And that's because the goal of what Maker is trying to achieve is ultimately to use DeFi and use blockchain technology to upgrade the real financial system and the real world. So I actually spend a considerable amount of my time, you know, talking to regulators and politicians and big companies and all of that stuff, right? And trying to figure out how can they start to use DeFi and you know, how can we make it less scary for them so that ultimately we can try to get this amazing technology and all the benefits it offers, you know, brought to the real world, so to speak, right? And in order to do that, I mean, you can't be anonymous and convince a regulator to allow you to use American mortgages as collateral in your DeFi project, for instance. There has to be that sense of, you know, of familiarity and responsibility that comes with you know, also having someone to ultimately, you know you got someone to chase after if there is an exit scam or something like that, right? And I think that's, I mean, in my opinion, that is, if you really want to make a difference, you have to put yourself out there, right? I mean, I'm talking about on a global scale. I think there is absolutely a time and a place for anonymous founders, right? And, you know, the perfect example is obviously Satoshi, right? But again, like, in terms, like, when we, if we really want to realize the full benefit of DeFi for the real world, you know, we have to be willing to step into the real world.
Yeah, so that's fair. Go for it, Rob. Sorry.
Yeah, so the ultimate goal, in my opinion, of any DeFi project is to get to a state of being trustless, where you don't have to trust anybody. You can assume that everybody in the system is evil and trying to steal your money, and the system works regardless. When Bitcoin launched, it launched in a position of being trustless. And so it could be anonymous. It didn't need there to be a known founder that you had to trust, because right out of the box, the system reached what a lot of DeFi projects, you know, have as the goal, and it takes years of like operating in a truly trustless fashion. Compound today, it took us 3 years, but we're finally a fully trustless system where if every single original developer of the protocol was completely evil and wicked, we still couldn't take your money. And that took years of work to get to this point. It's extremely complex and difficult, where, you know, our entire team could be wiped out in a meteor, you know, and the system would still work flawlessly. And that's hard. And so I think you need right now with these projects to take years to get to a fully decentralized and trustless state, known projects, because in the interim, there's still a level of trust, unfortunately. I think if an anonymous founder can ship a fully built end-to-end system that doesn't require any trust, then great. I think that's the best possible case. That's Bitcoin. And I think there's going to be teams that ship DeFi products out of the gate that are fully trustless and just work. Uniswap is a great example. Something like that where there's no admin keys, there's no privileges, could be an anonymous founder. But when there's privileged functions and privileged roles, I don't think being anonymous works until all of those rights get replaced with community control.
I just want to add, Rob, to that. Kind of a point that, and perspective that I think every developer has a right to be anonymous, and in some ways it basically helps them to be creative and kind of like build something new. And not everyone is in the same position that they can do the same thing without being anonymous. But I really agree on the point that if there is some privileged functions and it's very difficult to kind of attribute who that person is, it creates a lot of complexity. I mean, you can mitigate with time locks and so forth, but definitely it's kind of like a problematic thing. What I don't like in that much is when you use the anonymity kind of like to ruin the idea of basically being able to express things, whatever you are building and creating, but then you're using it to do some sort of like a scams and so forth. So it's very tricky point in that sense. But in very core, I think if system can run trustlessly, but it really takes time to get to that level, especially if you're dealing with traditional finance as well.
That's true. Eventually, you guys are going to have to retire when these things are huge and hand the gavel down. It's going to be a fun day. But Kane, moving on back to the yield farming idea. There's a whole spectrum of incentivization with yield farming and issuance of, you know, projects native token to the community. You guys were pretty aggressive in doing this and it worked quite well for you. So I'd love to start with you on how you guys decided on that spectrum. Like, how do you decide how aggressive to go to incentivize the community? Okay, you're muted real quick.
Yeah, sorry. We knew that we needed to be pretty aggressive to kind of start the flywheel going. When we started our staking incentives, it was like early 2019. And, you know, there were a few people left that were still, you know, clinging on for dear life to the project. But, it was definitely dark times. And so, you know, we made a decision to change the monetary policy and pretty aggressively start to distribute the inflationary rewards. And I think that that, you know, was the right call, and it was, you know, able to kind of build that core group of, you know, true believers who kind of stuck with the project.
Yeah, for sure. And Rob, you guys decided on a bit longer of a schedule. I mean, you did 4 years out of the gate. How did you guys land on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, it was designed to have some long-term distribution. What we wanted was for it not to be, you know, in 2 weeks, like some like current like token distribution strategies. You know, we're going to see lots of experiments from different communities. But I think, you know, all of these different projects are going to figure out the right calibration between long-term, short-term token distribution strategies, decentralization strategies, and incentives. You know, in my mind, I sort of looked at, you know, Bitcoin's distribution curve and, you know, used that as inspiration. You know, looking at, you know, our own mindset of how quickly can we go. You know, when we started, we actually thought that 4 years was fast, because we were looking at Bitcoin as like the proxy for distributing these rights. And so, you know, we believe that 4 years was the right time frame. I think, you know, history will either judge that correct or incorrect. But the nice thing about the process is that the community and the governance process of Compound can actually change the distribution process. It can speed it up, it can slow it down, it can, you know, make it go sideways or zig and zag, and the community can calibrate it. And that's one of the things that's a little bit more flexible than Bitcoin, where it's a much more immutable distribution curve.
Yeah, I'm with you there. That makes a lot of sense. 4 years it didn't feel long when you guys came out of the gate, and then we had projects launching with, you know, 2 weeks, things like you said. It was insane. Stanny, what about yourself? You guys released New Avenomics recently as well.
Yeah, I mean,
and you're kind of,
oh,
sorry.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Tom. Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of like, it's really hard to plan for years and years, because like the whole DeFi space is moving super fast. But in our Avenomics, we try to just figure out like what is the most important thing for our protocol and our community. And we kind of understood that once these protocols are growing substantially and they will have hundreds of millions and billions locked value, I mean, when we began this year with the protocol, we were expecting maybe that there will be 5 million worth of value locked in, but that's not the case. It has been substantial more. And during the 6 months, we tried to kind of think like how we can make the protocol as secure as possible and cover situations where there's substantial financial loss that could potentially arise. And during this 6 months, there was different kinds of events that happened. There was the Black Thursday, and for example, the Maker event of minting MKR to cover the protocol deficit, which worked pretty fine, and also the there was associated like the DAI backstop syndicate as well to support that initiative. And we're looking like all these different kinds of events and trying to like figure out like how we could actually ensure that our governance is aligned towards the safety. And in essence, the token holders are basically participating in risk-based decision-making. So we kind of have a risk transfer, and that is why our token holders are basically staking their tokens, taking the protocol risk, and that is somehow our view that how we could actually ensure this is safetiness. And we do like, we definitely like, when we saw the SNX compound model in terms of the rewards for the liquidity providers, that was very fascinating to us to follow. And kind of like what we are trying to do more is that we do have liquidity provider rewards, but they're pretty much compounded into the safety module, and trying to get the community aligned towards the safety of the protocol. And it's difficult to see like how it will play out, but at least like so far the community has been pretty positive about it.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's definitely a pendulum on incentivizing versus using up all your ammo and then potentially leaving a competitor to swoop in when you're kind of low. Rune, just switching gears a little bit here, I'd love to talk about governance a bit, because I first kind of got involved with governance with kind of MakerDAO, watching kind of the votes on the interest rates changes for your protocol. How do you think about ongoing governance, including a community, and also keeping in mind that the community could eventually, you know, burn out, and you don't want that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we've really been focusing on in Maker since the very beginning, right? And I actually think that the foundation of a good community and the foundation of good governance has to come from, in a sense, what I would call altruism, right? Like, I don't think that if you have, you know, a governance and community that is like the only incentive is some sort of monetary incentive and nothing else, there's no like vision, there's no like shared belief in the value of the system, then inevitably it's gonna, you know, like the fact that there's that solidarity doesn't exist is going to somehow like hurt the project in the long run, right? And I think that's the reason why the Maker community has always been so strong, because it's just always had this like very unique flavor to it, where it's a lot, like it's been a lot more kind of like, I guess you can say, maybe a little bit more old school or mature or something compared to a lot of other things in crypto. And that's just, it's always been like, that's exactly what Maker is supposed to be, right? And it's even reflected in the token economics of the MKR token, right? Where if you hold MKR, you're taking on the full risk of the system, and you're really just like putting your money where your mouth is. And any governance decision you make, if it blows up, if it turns out to be the wrong decision, you're gonna instantly have to pay for it directly. But I think moving forward in Maker, really the exercise, in fact, and sort of the big change that we've been trying to do in the community and in the foundation as well, at this point, it's been going on for about a year, is to figure out how to empower the community to start actually spending money that the protocol is earning in order to reward contributors. So basically, how do you get a decentralized organization to hire like full-time staff, create a real organization of people that are going to be working on the protocol? And I think it's like, this is not necessarily something that all protocols need. In fact, I think most don't really need it. But if you have something as complex and basically as sort of something where, you know, that's so important as an infrastructure, as a Maker, you just have to have these, you know, there has to be people who are responsible for constantly auditing the security of the protocol, for instance. But getting a decentralized community to properly like govern that is a big challenge, of course. But actually, it's been, like I said, there's already been this concept in the community for a year at this point, what's called domain teams. So basically teams that are, you know, they're responsible for different aspects of the protocol's well-being, that are then elected by the community, and very soon will also actually be paid directly by the community. And to me, that's really exciting, right? Because I think that's when you can start to see this kind of like, DeFi sort of like, breaking through sort of the shackles and sort of, you know, transcending the fact that, you know, we have this whole question of like the founder and the foundation and the organization behind it and so on, right? And really just having protocols and communities just being their completely own thing that really grow on their own, right? Through their own strength and their own decisions.
Rune, that's a really good point. I guess my question for the group here, though, is a lot of the protocols here are pretty complex for an everyday person to understand. So, like, doesn't it make sense to have some centralization in who's making the decisions on, let's say, you know, stability fees or, you know, risk or reserve ratios, or, you know, Kane, your platform's pretty complex as well. I mean, not when you use it, but on the inside as well. How do you guys think about that? Like, should there be set kind of smart plugged in people who are making decisions on behalf of the community on the governance side?
I think we're starting to see the necessity for that emerge, you know, as the implications of things and you know, the complexity increases, trying to, you know, especially as your community grows, right? You know, like this is again something that I think, the older projects deal with, where they have maybe, you know, thousands of people or even tens of thousands of people that are stakeholders in the project. And so, you know, trying to coordinate all those people to make the right decisions is really hard. And so I think, you know, there's different approaches that different projects have taken around, you know, trying to stay with like rough consensus, like, you know, Ethereum has, or on-chain governance. You know, we've kind of tried to, I guess, you know, take it slow and start with this rough consensus process. And but we are eventually going to need to migrate to some form of on-chain governance. So, you know, for us, I think it's just this this kind of evolutionary approach and you know, taking the feedback from the community and working out what the best thing for the project is at any given time in terms of governance.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And guys, switching over to one of my last questions, we'll turn over to kind of some live Q&A questions. It seems like eventually you guys will be built on other chains, you know, whether you guys decide or whether the community kind of takes you there. But it seems like at this point, it's kind of, you know, the decision of the founding teams on whether you want to build on other chains. So Ethereum's gas fees are insane. So there's kind of more of a reason to build on other chains. But the flip side is other chains don't have a lot of infrastructure or tokens to even really interact with. So it's kind of pointless at this point. What's your take on preemptively building on other chains? And how do you weigh that with the potential of kind of hurting your, you know, view of the ETH community? Could throw this out for anybody who wants to take it, by the way, because everyone here is built on Ethereum right now.
I'll just quickly say, you know, we already went down this path and you know, it was a pretty big mistake going down the EOS path in 2018. And, you know, we kind of, you know, rolled that back and decided to stick with Ethereum. So, you know, my view is I think, you know, we're pretty locked into ETH and, you know, we're looking at ETH scalability as the solution rather than other chains.
Yeah, also,
I really think... candid. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Ru.
Okay, so what I'm saying is I think that the moat or like the importance of not just like not exactly Ethereum, but rather I would say like the Ethereum main shot, right? Like the blockchain that everyone's building on right now and where everything is sort of connecting together. I think the importance of that just cannot be overstated. Like, and I really believe that it's completely impossible for anything to kind of like ever take its place as that role, which is kind of like, it's the central settlement layer, right? It's like the central point where if you want to interrupt, you want to collaborate and want to synergize with other projects, there's a really easy way to do it, which is to have some sort of connection on that blockchain. And that's actually why I also think that it's going to be like the center of the whole scalability explosion, right? Like, so the main Ethereum shard is where everything else is going to connect into in order to provide the scalability benefits, right? So I actually view even Ethereum killer blockchains as layer two solutions to some extent, right? That the only way that they're going to be able to compete, in my opinion, is if they provide a very high quality bridge to the Ethereum main shard. And that's what I think we already started to see that to some extent, right? That this is how a lot of new blockchains and new scalability solutions really differentiate and market themselves by saying that if you use us, you're going to have a really easy time also interacting with things on Ethereum. Because being able to interact with things on Ethereum is, you know, and in general, being able to synergize with other projects is the one thing that a DeFi project needs in order to have any sort of relevance. Like without that, you just don't really have the value of DeFi at all. So that's the starting point. And then the question is, how do you then access scalability in other places?
That's totally fair. Rob, Stanley, what about you guys? Do you think you'll ever have assets from other chains on Compound or Aave or even be built on other platforms?
So I think assets from other chains will make their way onto Ethereum. I think we're starting to see a lot more interoperability between blockchains. But I do think that most projects will live primarily on one blockchain. For a community to sort of try to run a project on two different blockchains, it's not twice as hard, it's probably four times as hard. It's a classic organizational theory piece there. And so I think like most projects will have just one home or one blockchain. And for the time being, Ethereum has massive advantages over most other chains. You know, as Rune pointed out, there's this composability. You know, it's like because everyone's in one place, nobody wants to leave that one place. Ethereum also has most of the assets. You know, if you look at other blockchains right now, there might be one or two tokens, you know, especially a native token, maybe a stable coin, but it doesn't have the ecosystem of all of the assets that are living on Ethereum today. You know, almost every new token that gets created, every yield farming thing, you know, for the most part, like 90% plus of like the really new assets are being launched on Ethereum right now. So there's a network effect that's hard to break. So I think that, you know, the path that this might play out is as there's like interoperability between blockchains, you might see assets from other blockchains being replicated on Ethereum. You might see Ethereum assets being replicated on other blockchains. And over time, you know, you might start to see you know, one asset being issued simultaneously on many blockchains. And eventually, once there's like 100 different really good, liquid, high-quality assets on a blockchain, you might start to see DeFi projects that can operate in single-player mode, that don't need interoperability with lots of other projects, make the leap and say, okay, you know, because we don't need to work with other projects right now, and there's finally a lot of like really interesting assets, now we're going to build a great DeFi project.
I think for Aave, the headquarters is always Ethereum. I mean, we were basically born and raised here, but I would definitely love to see more assets coming into Ethereum, and especially assets that people are just holding and they don't have any kind of like a additional utility and usability. And we'll probably see more bridges of this, and we'll definitely love to see this in Ethereum. But I would love to also see that if there is a kind of like alternative consensus mechanisms in other blockchains, I would love to see that their communities will grow and flourish in a way that they become kind of like they will have their own culture and so forth. And I think like replicating what there is in Ethereum, I don't think that is like a workable thing. But I could imagine that if there is some sort of blockchain or layer two solution just for gaming, like for example Matic, and you will see a lot of games NFTs there. I would love to see that kind of stuff more. Yeah,
that's awesome. And guys, we have a couple minutes left, so I'll turn over to one of the live Q&A questions. And somebody asked basically the kind of the interplay between DeFi and the global banking industry. And you know, when I first got into crypto, I left Wall Street, and then I thought, you know, can't wait for the, you know, Wall Street to form partnerships with DeFi projects. Then now I'm like, can't wait for DeFi to just crush Wall Street and banking projects. And now I think that basically the consumer facing banking apps have just massive distribution and could really help DeFi projects get exposure. What's your guys' take on DeFi actually challenging or just completely displacing the global financial industry?
Well, the compound strategy is to be good enough for a traditional bank to allow their customers to use. You know, I envision an ecosystem in which, you know, 5 years from now, you know, large, you know, well-known banks, you know, supply assets to Compound. And everything that, you know, the community does and we set the vision for is to enable that. Eventually banks, you know, supplying their assets to Compound. You know, for the protocol, that means focusing on safety, having less assets, less risk, less volatility, less innovation in some sense, to make a more stable and predictable system. And I think, you know, DeFi is going to win when, you know, existing financial institutions are able to use it. Because, you know, for the time being, existing financial systems are orders of magnitude larger than crypto. And so, you know, my vision is that DeFi, you know, will be used by traditional finance, and traditional finance will supply assets into DeFi. Not that, you know, one has to kill the other. I think DeFi will suck in all of the assets over time.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm excited for that. Rude, go for it.
Yeah, I don't really expect, and actually I hope that DeFi isn't gonna like crush the system or kill the banks or something, but I do hope that it'll accelerate a trend that I think is already happening to some extent, right? Which is the unbundling of banks and financial institutions, right? So actually to Robert's point that, you know, you might see banks in the future focusing less on building these like underlying interest rate protocols and sort of underlying interest rate systems, and instead focusing on how to like market what's already there and pick the best stuff for the users, right? And then bring it to the users. And what we think of as the banking brands of today will in the future be actually more, you know, maybe in the very long run, like be like DeFi front ends, right? For instance, to really, be futuristic about it. And what's, I mean, one of the ways this is already happening right now is with, you know, the tokenization of real world assets and sort of the very early attempts to bring real world assets into DeFi, because what we're actually seeing is things like, in Maker, and I believe also in Aave, that there is these like, I mean, right now it's primarily in real estate and then in trade finance where the opportunity just is already there. The product market fit is very close. And what you can really do is you can completely like circumvent all the middlemen that right now are a part of like these large financial transactions of that actually had like incredible just like efficiency losses from all the middlemen basically. So like if in the future we're able to fund things like real estate construction projects or you know international do trade finance for international invoices and so on through DeFi, meaning that you know you can just fund something directly based on its on how sound it is financially, that's really gonna well, first of all, like cut out a lot of middlemen that just shouldn't be there at all. You know, they're only there because the system is inefficient. But then also really just like make a big difference in how, you know, how the global economy functions, right? Because shaving off a few percentage of interest rates is gonna, like that's gonna have major repercussions for just like, you know, pretty much every aspect of the economy.
I think I'm definitely in the crush camp myself. You know, I think that these new forms of coordination that, you know, we're seeing emerge in DeFi have the potential to, you know, really change the landscape of finance. And I think the missing link right now is the kind of hybrid connectivity between what, you know, DeFi is doing, these, you know, very transparent systems and you know, the legacy financial infrastructure. And so I think that what we're probably going to see is legacy finance starting to, you know, adopt some of the DeFi primitives that are being built to gain a competitive advantage, which is going to be the first kind of step to this erosion of, you know, the legacy systems and replacement with, you know, much more open and transparent systems. That's my hope. That's my hope at least.
Yeah, we'll definitely see what happens. Well, guys, this has been an awesome panel. It's hard to get all four of you guys in a room together, so I'm glad we had, you know, Rune from MakerDAO, Stanley from Aave, Kane from Synthetics, and Rob from Compound. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.